Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. This week, an introduction to Chris Hedges and a survey of what happens when corporations rule the country. I hope you'll stay tuned. Chris Hedges has an interesting and idiosyncratic mind. He's the sort of guy who could graduate from Harvard Divinity School and then immediately begin a long career as a newspaper war correspondent, as in fact he did. His books of cultural criticism are well worth reading. The best known is titled War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, published in 2002. I confess that his writing style is not perfectly to my taste. It's a bit orotund, or some might say flowery, as though he had read too many 19th century sermons back in divinity school. But when he speaks in public, his style works much better. He spoke in Winnipeg, Canada in October 2009, delivering a beautifully crafted 50-minute long oration with a good handful of themes intricately woven together. He managed to connect Michael Jackson's funeral, the corporate control of America, the banking crisis, the climate crisis, Obama, Clinton, NAFTA, Renaissance courtiers, socialism, the media, and end up back at Michael Jackson's funeral. I can't split the talk in half and broadcast it in two installments, any more than you could listen to Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, split between two consecutive Tuesdays with a week of silence in the middle. You have to hear it at one sitting. In fact, you can. On this show's website, you'll find a link to an MP3 recording of the speech, uncut. You can listen to it online, or you can download the file and listen later. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. I'm going to play some substantial portions of the speech here and now. Hedges is paraphrasing and reading from his recent book, Empire of Illusion. His point in this section is that when corporations rule the country, they destroy real politics and give us packaged, if nearly interchangeable, brands instead. We've just switched from brand W to brand Obama, and the change in our lives has been about as huge as if we had switched from Pepsi to Coke. That's my metaphor, not Hedges. Chris Hedges is entirely capable of crafting his own metaphors, so let's let him.
In his book, Democracy Incorporated, Sheldon Wolin, who taught political philosophy at Berkeley and later at Princeton, uses the phrase inverted totalitarianism to describe our political system. Inverted totalitarianism, unlike classical totalitarianism, does not revolve around a demagogue or charismatic leader. It finds its expression in the anonymity of the corporate state. It purports to cherish democracy, patriotism, and electoral politics while manipulating internal levers to subvert and thwart democratic institutions. Political candidates are elected in popular votes, but are beholden to armies of corporate lobbyists in capitals who author the legislation and get the legislators to pass it. The corporate media controls nearly everything we read, watch, or hear, and imposes a bland uniformity of opinion. It diverts us with trivia and celebrity gossip. In classical totalitarian regimes, such as Nazi fascism or Soviet communism, economics was subordinate to politics. Under inverted totalitarianism, the reverse is true, Wolin writes. Economics dominates politics, and with that domination comes different forms of ruthlessness. The Obama brand offers us an image that appears radically individualistic and new. This image inoculates us from seeing that the old engines of corporate power and the vast military-industrial complex continue to plunder our country. Brand Obama is about being happy consumers. We are entertained, we feel hopeful, we like our president, we believe he is like us. But like all branded products spun out from the manipulative world of corporate advertising, we are being duped into doing and supporting a lot of things that are not in our interest. What for all our faith and hope has the Obama brand given us? His administration has spent, lent, or guaranteed $12.8 trillion in taxpayer dollars to Wall Street and insolvent banks in a doomed effort to reinflate the bubble economy, a tactic that at best forestalls catastrophe and will leave us broke in a time of profound crisis. Brand Obama has allocated nearly $1 trillion in defense-related spending and the continuation of the doomed imperial project in Iraq, where military planners now estimate that 70,000 troops will remain for the next 15 to 20 years. Brand Obama has expanded the war in Afghanistan, including the use of drones sent on cross-border bombing runs into Pakistan that have left over 700 civilians dead since Obama took office. And Brand Obama has refused to ease restrictions so workers can organize, and because of pressure from our for-profit healthcare industry, will not consider single-payer, not-for-profit healthcare for all Americans. And Brand Obama will not prosecute the Bush administration for war crimes, including the use of torture, and has refused to dismantle Bush's secrecy laws or restore habeas corpus. Corporations, which control our politics, no longer produce products that are different, but brands that are different. Brand Obama does not threaten the core of the corporate state anymore than did brand George W. Bush. The Bush brand collapsed. We became immune to its studied folksiness. We saw through its artifice, and this is a common deflation in the world of advertising. So we have been given a new Obama brand with an exciting and faintly erotic appeal. Benetton and Calvin Klein were the precursors to the Obama brand, using ads to associate themselves with risque style and progressive politics. It gave their products an edge. But the goal, as with all brands, was to fool passive consumers that a brand is an experience. The decline of the American empire began long before the current economic meltdown or the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. It began before the first Gulf War or Ronald Reagan. It began when we shifted, in the words of the historian Charles Mayer, from an empire of production to an empire of consumption. By the end of the Vietnam War, when the costs of the war ate away at Lyndon Johnson's great society, and domestic oil production began its steady, inexorable decline, we saw the United States transformed from one that primarily produced to one that primarily consumed. Americans started borrowing to maintain a lifestyle as well as an empire they could no longer afford, and they began to use force, especially in the Middle East, to feed an insatiable thirst for cheap oil. And the bill is now due. America's most dangerous enemies are not Islamic radicals, but those who sold the public the perverted ideology of free market capitalism and globalization. They have dynamited the foundations of society. In the 17th century, these speculators would have been hung. Today, they run the government and consume billions in taxpayer subsidies. These corporate forces will never permit real reform. It would mean their extinction. The oil and gas industry will never allow us to achieve energy independence. That would devastate their profits. Real reform would wipe out tens of billions of dollars in weapons contracts and cripple the health of a host of private contractors from Lockheed Martin to Northrop Grumman to Raytheon. It was Bill Clinton who led the Democratic Party to the corporate watering trough. Clinton argued that the party could ditch labor unions, no longer a source of votes or power, as a political ally. Workers, he insisted, would vote Democratic anyway. They had no choice. It was better, he argued, to take corporate money and do corporate bidding. By the 1990s, the Democratic Party, under Clinton's leadership, had virtual fundraising parity with the Republicans. Today, the Democrats get more. The legislation demanded by corporations including the North American Free Trade Agreement, thrust a knife into the back of our working class. NAFTA was peddled by the Clinton White House as an opportunity to raise incomes and prosperity of the citizens of the United States, Canada, and Mexico. NAFTA would also, we were told, staunch Mexican immigration into the United States. But NAFTA, which took effect in 1994, had the effect of reversing every one of Clinton's rosy predictions. Once the Mexican government lifted price supports on corn and beans grown by Mexican farmers, those farmers had to compete against the huge agribusinesses in the United States. Many Mexican farmers were swiftly bankrupt. At least 2 million Mexican farmers have been driven off their land since 1994. And guess where many of them went? This desperate flight of poor Mexicans into the United States is now being exacerbated by large-scale factory closures along the border as manufacturers pack up and leave Mexico for the cut-rate embrace of China's totalitarian capitalism. But we were assured that goods would be cheaper, workers would be wealthier, everyone would be happier. I'm not sure how these contradictory things were supposed to happen, but in a soundbite society, reality no longer matters. NAFTA was great if you were a corporation. It was a disaster if you were a worker. And we in the United States are now getting a taste of Clinton's draconian welfare reform bill, signed in 1996, as millions of people begin to lose their unemployment benefits and attempt to survive on $143 a month from welfare. It was the Clinton administration, led by Summers, which signed into law the Financial Services Modernization Act of 1999. The act ripped down the firewalls that had been established by the 1933 Glass-Steagall Act. And because your firewalls were not ripped down, Canada does not have a banking crisis. These firewalls were designed to prevent the kind of meltdown the United States is now undergoing. Glass-Steagall established the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. It set in place banking reforms to stop speculators from hijacking the financial system. With Glass-Steagall demolished and the passage of NAFTA, the Democrats, led by Clinton, tumbled gleefully into bed with corporations and Wall Street speculators. And many of the architects of this deregulation, economists such as Summers, have come back again to service these corporations in the Obama White House. The cost of our empire of illusion is not being paid for by corporate titans. It is being paid for on the streets of our inner cities, in former manufacturing towns, and in depressed rural enclaves. Human beings are not commodities. They are not goods. Their misery is not the regrettable price of globalization and the free market. They grieve and suffer and feel despair. They raise children and struggle to maintain communities. The growing class divide is not understood, despite the glibness of many in the media, by complicated sets of statistics, lines on a graph that charts stocks, or the absurd utopian faith in unregulated globalization and complicated trade deals. It is understood in the eyes of a man or woman who is no longer making enough money to live with dignity and hope. The growing desperation sweeping across the United States is unleashing not simply a recession. We in the industrialized world have been in recession for many years now, but a depression unlike anything we have seen since the 1930s. It has provided a pool of broken people willing to work for low wages and to do without unions or benefits. And this is excellent news if you are a corporation. It is very bad news if you are a worker. For the bottom 90% of Americans' annual income has been on a slow, steady decline for 3 decades. And there are now 50 million Americans in real poverty and tens of millions of Americans in a category called near poverty. The assault on the American working class, an assault that has devastated members of my own family in the former mill towns in the state of Maine shows no sign of abatement. In the past 3 years, nearly one in five U.S. workers was laid off. There has been a Weimarization of the American working class, and the assault on the middle class is underway. Anything that can be put on software, from finance to architecture to engineering, can and is being outsourced to workers in countries such as India or China. Our media has evolved into a class of courtiers. Our political parties are populated by courtiers. Our pundits, academics, economists, and experts, at least those with public platforms, are courtiers. And we are captivated by the hollow stagecraft of political theater as we are ruthlessly stripped of power. The role of courtiers is always to parrot official propaganda. Courtiers do not defy the elite or question the structure of the corporate state, and these corporations in return employ them and promote them as celebrities or elected officials. Courtiers in face powder deceive us in the name of journalism. Courtiers in our political parties promise to look out for our interests and then pass bill after bill to further corporate fraud and abuse. And being a courtier requires agility and eloquence. The most talented of them should be credited as persuasive actors. They entertain us. They make us feel good. They persuade us. They are our friends. They are the smiley faces of a corporate state that has hijacked power.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those Nazis in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from a field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA. Sail on, oh man, yeah, ship of state. best of the worst. It's here they got the range and the machinery for change, and it's here they got the spiritual thirst. It's here the family's broken, and it's here the lonely say that the heart has got to open in a fundamental way. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Leonard Cohen, offering a note of hope in counterpoint to Chris Hedges' Jeremiad. In the selection from his Winnipeg speech that we heard, Hedges discussed inverted totalitarianism, where the state uses its coercive power not for its own ends, like Nazi Germany, but in order to serve powerful economic interests. He talked about Brand Obama, which functions much like Brand Calvin Klein, and the evils done to people by the courtiers who serve the powerful. Evils including NAFTA and the destruction of banking regulations. These courtiers include Obama, the Congress, and the media. Let's return to the talk by Chris Hedges. In the next segment, he discusses how the American media actively promote anti-democratic forces and at the same time deceive citizens into not rebelling against the forces that are destroying them. And he goes on to argue that Americans' best hope lies in building a strong movement for democratic socialism.
Mass culture assures us, even in the midst of these catastrophes, that if we close our eyes, if we visualize what we want, if we have faith in ourselves, if we tell God that we believe in miracles, if we tap into our inner strength, if we grasp that we are truly exceptional, if we focus on happiness, our lives will be harmonious and complete. This cultural retreat into illusion, whether peddled by positive psychologists, Hollywood, or Christian preachers, is a form of magical thinking. It turns worthless mortgages and debt into wealth. It turns the destruction of our manufacturing base into an opportunity for growth. It turns alienation and anxiety into cheerful conformity. It turns a nation that wages illegal wars and administers offshore penal colonies where it openly practices torture into the greatest democracy on earth. It is time to fight back against corporate culture in small and large ways. Coalitions of environmental, anti-nuclear, anti-capitalist, sustainable agriculture, and anti-globalization forces are coalescing to form and support socialist parties. This has yet to happen in the United States. The left never rallied in significant numbers behind Cynthia McKinney or Ralph Nader, and this was our mistake. In picking the lesser of two evils, it threw its lot in with a Democratic Party that, again, has proven that it backs our imperial wars, empowers the national security state, does the bidding of corporations, and ignores the needs of citizens. If Obama does not end the flagrant theft of taxpayer funds by corporations and the abandonment of our working class, especially as foreclosures and unemployment mount, many in the United States will turn in desperation to the far right, embodied by groups such as Christian radicals. The failure of progressives to offer a credible, democratic, socialist alternative, the only alternative that can now save our open society, to openly make war on corporate power, will mean that there will be in the eyes of many embittered and struggling, working and middle class people, no alternative but a perverted Christian fascism. I spent 2 years traveling the country to write a book on the Christian right called American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America. I visited former manufacturing towns where for many, the end of the world is no longer an abstraction. They have lost hope. Fear and instability have plunged the working class into profound personal and economic despair, and not surprisingly, into the arms of demagogues and charlatans of the radical Christian right who offer a belief in magic, miracles, and the fiction of a utopian Christian nation. And unless we rapidly re-enfranchise these dispossessed workers back into the economy, unless we give them hope, democracy is doomed. Democracies, as writers as ancient as Plutarch and Thucydides understood, cannot be sustained in oligarchic states. We forgot that social reform never comes from accommodating the power structure, but from frightening it. The Liberty Party, which in the United States fought slavery, the suffragists who battled for women's rights, the labor movement, the civil rights movements knew that the question was not, how do we get good people to rule? Most of those attracted to power are at best mediocrities and often venal. But how do we limit the damage the powerful do to us? These mass movements were the real engines of social reform, the correctives to our democracy, and the true protectors of the rights of citizens. We must, all of us, begin to opt out of the mainstream, to rebuild socialism as a viable political force. We must no longer be content with the crumbs tossed to us in the vain hope that we can influence the power elite from the inside. We must become as militant as those who seek our enslavement. If we remain passive, we will soon be engulfed by a ruthless totalitarian capitalism. If we remain passive, as we undergo the largest transference of wealth upwards in history, we will become serfs. If we fight back, we have a chance. The saturation coverage of Jackson's death was one of many examples of our collective flight into illusion. It deflected the moral questions arising from mounting social injustice, growing inequalities, failing imperial wars, economic collapse, and political corruption. As we sink into an economic morass, as we barrel towards a crisis that will create more misery than the Great Depression, we remain controlled, manipulated, and distracted by the celluloid shadows on the wall of Plato's cave. The fantasy of celebrity culture is not designed simply to entertain. It is designed to drain us emotionally, confuse us about our identity, blame ourselves for our predicament, condition us to chase illusions of impossible fame and happiness, and keep us from fighting back. And in the end, that is all the Jackson coverage was really about. Another tawdry and tasteless spectacle to divert a dying culture from the baying wolf at the gate. Thank you.
And thank you for listening. New World Notes comes to you from WWUH-FM, a community service of the University of Hartford. NewWorldNotes.blogspot.com. Ila gitamai non carborundum and ciao.
Democracy is coming to the USA.